Greetings, and welcome to CatastropheCast.com. My name is Walter. I'm the webmaster and podcaster for CatastropheCast.com. And today I wanted to launch our very first actual podcast about a catastrophe with the American Airlines Flight 191 out of Chicago. This was a DC-10 crash in 1979 that just happened to occur on Friday, May 25th, 1979. The day that I'm putting this out is Friday, May 25th, 2012. It's the actual and symbolic anniversary of American Airlines Flight 191 crash, because that crash happened on the Friday before Memorial Day, and today happens to be that Friday before Memorial Day. A little bit of history. American Airlines was the launch customer for the McDonnell Douglas DC-10. The plane itself was conceived in the mid-1960s, and it was meant to be a competitor of the Boeing 747. Like the Boeing 747, it had a three-man crew, the pilot, co-pilot, and the flight engineer. Now, this particular flight, the aircraft itself was just 7 years old at the time of the crash. The pilot of the flight was Captain Walter Lux. He was, at the time, one of the most senior pilots for American Airlines and one of the most experienced DC-10 captains for American Airlines. The flight originated in Chicago. It was at gate K5. If you've ever flown American Airlines, especially any of the large planes, if you were going overseas, you have probably left out of one of the K gates. I know personally I have flown out of gate K5 before. The flight was given permission to taxi out at 2:50. It made its way out to the runway, and at 3:02 p.m., it was given permission to take off. Now, the crash itself happened really, really fast. The flight crew started their roll down the taxiway for takeoff, and just as they were coming off the ground, about 6,000 feet down the runway, the number one engine separated from the plane. In these cases, when an engine separates from a plane, what happens is the engine, because it's no longer attached, has no load to carry, it actually accelerates to be in front of the plane as it detaches. So the engine detaches, flies in front of the plane, and then flies back over the wing. Now, that's exactly what happened in this case. It flew off, went in front of the wing, and then over the wing. In doing this, what happened was it hit several key components. So the engine separation hit the slats. It hit other components that were contained within the wing. And it did some major damage to hydraulic lines and such. The bad thing is, in this particular incident, the captain was actually doing the flying of the plane. And when the engine detached and took out the different components, such as the hydraulic lines and such, it actually took out several of the instruments that went directly to the captain's control panel. So the flight crew, all they thought was the number one engine has failed during takeoff, and they were starting their proper procedure. They actually had no idea that the engine had separated it from the plane. The flight went to about 400 feet. The captain and co-pilot and flight engineer, they all did what they were supposed to do during engine failure. They followed all the proper procedures as the NTSB found. They just did not know that their instruments were not working properly on the captain's side because of the damage that occurred. So the plane went into a basic stall as it was about 400 feet off the ground. In the stall, the plane rolled over onto its left side, And if you've ever seen a picture of, or investigated, or looked into this crash at all, you'll know that there is an iconic photo of this plane in the air on its side. It's almost as if the plane was standing on the wing. This was taken by an amateur photographer, and you can clearly see, what's about to happen. The odd thing that I did not know when I was researching this was that the passengers on the plane were actually able to watch what was going on in the cockpit through closed circuit TV feed. So they were able to watch the monitors overhead, because at that time, of course, there was only a monitor overhead. They didn't have the seat back TVs like we have these days. And those people were able to watch exactly what the captain and the flight crew saw when that plane crashed. That personally is something that really took me aback when I heard this, when I read this bit. So the plane starts its descent, of course. It crashes downfield just off the runway. It goes crashes into a hangar, killing two people that were in the hangar, and then the plane continued because it was going so fast to plow after the hangar. It went into a trailer park that was at the basically at the end of the runway, and it tore into several of the trailers there, and it finally came to rest. There's another iconic picture of this crash, and it is of a giant fireball. And you can imagine this plane as it came down. It had 275 passengers. It had a crew of 13, I believe, and had killed other people on the ground. The plane itself was full of fuel. So you can imagine a fully loaded, fully fueled DC-10 coming down into a populated area. How giant a fireball would be. So immediately, there's finger pointing going on and everything. The NTSB started in and tried to figure out what was going on, because that is, of course, their job, the National Transportation Safety Board. They investigate airline crashes. As I said, this happened in 1979. What was going on in 1979? Well, it was during the Carter administration. We had rampant inflation. It was just insane. So people were all thinking about money. They were, thinking, what can we do to save money? That was the mentality at the time. We had gone from, I mean, I know I was a kid in the 1970s. I remember the fuel crisis. I remember different things that happened during that time that affected my mom as the sole breadwinner of the family and how we were going to survive as kids. American Airlines, Continental Airlines, and United Airlines all flew the DC-10. And when you are a major airline, you commit to buying planes for the traveling public, of course, and you commit to taking care of those planes. During this time, people are thinking, okay, so what can we do to save money? What can we do to save this? What can we do to save that? Because every penny counted. So, 1979, when this crash happened, this was soon after deregulation of the airline industry. So, people were, of course, what can I do to save money? So, American, Continental, and United, they all flew the DC-10. In order to save money, when the maintenance crews took over and started to do maintenance on the planes, they actually found that although McDonnell Douglas said, in order to do proper maintenance on the plane, first you remove the engine, then you remove the pylon. But what American, Continental, and United maintenance crews found was they could actually save about 200 man hours per aircraft, which, I mean, when you think about it, that's a lot. In doing this and saving these 200 man hours per aircraft by taking off the pylon and the engine as one piece, The maintenance crews actually threw in an additional little benefit, and that is, hey, I only have to separate 27 lines, hydraulic lines, fuel lines, etc. I only have to separate 27 of those if I do it as one piece, as opposed to having to separate 72. This in itself actually sounds like a pretty good thing, because when you think about it, if I'm only doing 27 separations as opposed to 72, that is two-thirds less separations. And in the future, is it going to be easier for me to do this? Absolutely. So this was their way of getting around it. Ironically, McDonnell Douglas knew how American, United, and Continental were all doing this maintenance. And they said, and this is an actual quote from McDonnell Douglas, they said they didn't have the authority to either approve or disapprove the maintenance procedures of its customers. When you think about it, that is a pretty big thing. American and Continental, in deciding to take the engine and pylon, the pylon is the part that holds the engine on, in deciding to take these off as one unit, they used a forklift. United decided to use a hoist. The United procedure was probably a little easier because using the hoist, they didn't have to worry about this forklift. As the NTSB found, the forklift procedure itself was really, really hard to do. And it's because you had to hold the engine straight during the entire procedure. It's not something that was very easily done. Now, for this particular DC-10, there was an additional issue having to do with the maintenance. Now, the maintenance happened 8 weeks prior to the crash of the airplane. During the maintenance, what happened was someone took the forklift, put it to the engine so that it could hold the engine in place, but the engine seesawed. So during a shift change, which occurred during the middle of the maintenance on this particular DC-10, the engine had seesawed, so therefore the forklift had to be repositioned again. Basically, what ended up happening was the seesawing effect of the engine on the forklift caused a structural failure to begin within this pylon facility. The plane continued to fly for 7 weeks after this, and during that 8th week, on May 25th, 1979, the pylon became so fragile that it broke due to this jamming that happened when they did the maintenance. And on Friday, May 25th, 1979, that plane crashed down in Chicago. Soon after the crash, the DC-10 fleet was grounded. What happened was there was a passenger advocate named James Dunn, and he sued for all DC-10s to be grounded, which the FAA basically did by withdrawing the operation certificate of the DC-10 to fly within American airspace on June 6, 1979. As I was getting ready for the podcast, I actually read an interview with James Dunn in People magazine, and people had asked him why he was doing what he did, and his quote was, "These planes are just not built for engines to fly off." It's interesting that he used that particular phrase, only because technically the engine did exactly what it was supposed to do. Unfortunately, based on how the DC-10 had different components going through the left wing, and that number one engine separation basically taking out not only the engine, but different components that go through the wing at the same time, disabling what the captain was able to do. As I said before, he had no idea that his instruments were actually not functioning. The McDonnell Douglas Company had to redo instrumentation throughout the DC-10 so that were this to happen again in the future, it would not be as catastrophic. So the DC-10 after this crash did not have the best reputation, of course. It had been grounded, it had to have some redesign done. There were other crashes that happened that hit at the reputation of the DC-10. Air New Zealand Flight 901, it was a sightseeing flight in Antarctica. It hit a mountain. But that was due to several different human factors, basically. There were other accidents that took away. It just seemed that the DC-10 seemed to be cursed in some way. Ironically, it was a 1989 crash of another DC-10, the United Airlines Flight 232, that crashed in Sioux City, Iowa, that restored some of that reputation. There were 185 people that actually survived the accident, and the experts actually attribute how well made the DC-10 was and how sturdy it was in its construction that was partially responsible for how many people survived that horrific crash. Now, I remember, of course, when I was a kid, and I always thought that this was some sort of folklore, that Lindsey Wagner was supposed to be on American Airlines Flight 191. But in doing investigations for this, it was actually true. Lindsey Wagner was supposed to be on American Airlines Flight 191 from Chicago and decided not to fly. There were quite a few other people amongst the 275. Even one soul lost is too many. But there were some different notable victims of the crash. The man who invented the cardiac catheter, his name was Itzhak Bentov. He was killed in the crash. There were also several people who were part of the American Bookseller Association that all had some sort of relationship with Playboy magazine that were killed in the crash. They were all headed to a convention in Los Angeles and a party afterward, thrown by Hugh Hefner, of course. And so several of those people were on the plane and they died in the crash. One other bit of information that I did not know. I did know that the American Airlines Flight 191 crash was the worst single aviation disaster on American soil. So I did know that fact. But what I did not know was there was not a memorial dedicated to the American Airlines crash until 2011. 32 years later, so 1 year ago today, as I record this, there was a dedication of a memorial for all of the victims of the crash. Of this, American Airlines donated $21,500, and there was a bunch of money that was actually raised by school kids to get this done. There's a little bit more oddities that I wanted to point out about this airline crash. When there is an airline crash that happens, that flight number basically is retired. It does not come back. It is removed from use. KAL Flight 007 that was shot down by the Soviets. United Airlines Flight 93, that's one of the September 11th hijacking planes. Those flight numbers have been retired. One thing about Flight 93 itself, when United and Continental merged, they accidentally brought back United Airlines Flight 93, and it wasn't until somebody pointed it out to them that they decided to retire it again. The other odd thing about flight number 191, not just Americans, there are other flight 191 crashes and incidents that have occurred that have actually been pretty big. Delta Airlines Flight 191 was a plane leaving Dallas-Fort Worth, of course, which is ironically American Airlines hub. It was an L-1011, a competitor to the DC-10, and that crash is mostly responsible for wind shear notifications that exist on airplanes now, because that plane was brought down by wind shear. So there was Delta Flight 191, that flight number was retired. Comair Flight 191, which was a Dash 8 that crashed, killing 49 people on board, I believe. And then, actually, just earlier this year, there was JetBlue Flight 191. That one did not crash. However, that one has the distinction of our pilot went crazy and had to be subdued by passengers. We need to make an emergency landing. There is a bit of a odd history about flights numbered 191. So you can take a look at that. There's actually a Wikipedia article that goes into much more detail on all of these pieces. So that's just about it. I just wanted to put this one out there today because, in honor and respect of all those people lost on Flight 191, May 25th, 1979, may they all rest in peace. And I wanted to add two more things. You may hear in the background, ironically, planes flying overhead. Somehow, the flight pattern for Portland International Airport, which I live about 25 miles from, they seem to have changed the flight pattern. So I apologize if you hear the planes in the background, but they have changed the flight pattern. It's a beautiful day in the Portland, Oregon area. And I now have planes flying overhead every 30 seconds. So apologize for that. If you have questions, please don't hesitate to email me. The email address is podcast@catastrophecast.com, or just come over to catastrophecast.com, leave a comment, let me know what you would like to see covered. I'm actually going to try to do podcasts every couple to 3 weeks, depending on my work schedule, and I don't have an idea yet for what I'd like to cover in the next podcast. So, what would you like to see? So, until next time, thanks for listening.